This is Phil Ferrin, and I am actually already home. These have been some exciting days. Sorry, I'm messing around with the recorder here to make sure that it's recording. Anyways, yes, so there's just been all kinds of excitement around here. As I mentioned last week, my car, wait, maybe that was after I did the podcast last week. So I've been driving my dad's old creature car for, Lance, I don't know, 5 years now, something like that. It's a good old car, 1998 Lincoln Continental, you know, it's a good old creature car. And it's, you know, it's been fine. I got home, I think it was last Thursday night, and I ran down to just check on something on the little rock house that we have. And I got out, checked on it, got back in the car, started up the car, put it in gear, and nothing. I mean, it just, you know, died immediately. So I tried it again, died immediately. Maybe this was Wednesday this happened, Wednesday of last week. Anyways, managed to nurse it back, to rev it up enough, put it in gear, rev it up enough, put it in gear to get it back over to my house and get it up on the cement pad. And I just left it there, called the mechanic. They said they could look at it on Monday of this week. So had the car towed down there. They looked at it on Monday. I had borrowed my mother-in-law's car, worked from home, you know, was able to cover that kind of stuff, worked from home. No, it was like last Tuesday. Anyways, worked from home the rest of the week. And then borrowed my mother-in-law's car. I'm sitting here trying to reconstruct all the events in my head. I should have thought about this a little bit before I started this to remember the order, because it's not that important, so I just dumped it off. The upshot of it all is that I did have the car looked at on Monday, and it's dead. It's just dead. So it's sadness, because the transmission was going out on it, and there's no point. Transmission is $2,500, and it's a 1998 Lincoln Continental. So, yeah, it's dead. So anyways, that has spawned a car hunt now. And so on Wednesday, I went ahead and rented myself a car. It's a little Volkswagen Jetta. It's a real nice little car. Wouldn't pay what prices are. Quickly discovered, starting to hunt for a car, that car prices are just crazy right now. Used car prices are just silly. Just silly. So have a couple of leads as potentials. So, you know, that's all well and good. I'm thinking about getting a Honda Fit. They're actually subcompacts, but they tell me that I will fit in it, no problem, and that it's, it actually has a convertible, configurable back, so the seats flop down a couple of different ways, and, you know, the front seat, driver's seat flops down, so you have that much storage, and then you can flip the back seats up and go the tall format, and so they've put a lot of thought into how to get a decent amount of hauling space in a very, very small car. So and they're pretty cool looking little cars. So I think I've got a couple options. We're working on that. I found one car that has a story. And I love anything with a story. So it's going to be interesting to see if I end up with this one. But got more work to do, got more talking to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm in the hunt now. I actually went down to one of the car dealerships today where they had, to give you an idea how crazy used car prices are right now. So a buddy of mine found this one. It's a Honda Fit. It was 2008, course, this is the end of 2022, so it's 2008. Basically, it's 15 years old. This car is 15 years old. It was a 2008. It had 80,000 miles on it. And they were selling it at this car dealership for $9,900. $9,900 for a 2008 15-year-old car with 80-some-odd thousand miles on it. What in the world? But I guess there's a car shortage, and used car prices are up by like 50%, and it's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So the housing market, it looks like it is starting to come down. I would guess over the next year that the car market is going to really start coming down as well. But I need a car now. So Jesus will help us. We'll just see how this all goes about. There is one in Russellville, Arkansas, that is a really, really interesting car. And I'm doing some more research, and we're going to see how that all goes. But has a story. It has a really interesting story. I'm trying to get what the rest of the story is. But I'm still in process for that, so... so we'll go from there. Anyways, okay, so there we go. That's it. Writing, I have finished up all the files for Book 17, got them all uploaded, got the free copies ordered. So that's all good. I'm going back and doing the read-through on Book 8. That has gotten slowed down a little bit because of the car troubles. But we're going to be okay. As long as I'm ready to start writing on January 1st, that'll all be good. And I've got time, and I'm about halfway through the read-through from what I had already previously written, and that seems to be fine. And so I think we're good. We're good. We're good. We're good. Moving forward there. Costumes are good. I finished dyeing all the ropes. I have to whip the ends of the ropes now. Once I get that done, then I'm going to start designing the actual costume with the ropes. And we'll see how that all goes. I think that's going to go fine. And I think it will be interesting. If it's not, I just won't wear it. So then once I get that all done, I'm going to start on the costume for National Nude Day. Build my homage to Nudie Cohen, the rodeo cowboy. The rodeo tailor, not the rodeo cowboy. So that should be fun. And then we'll see, this one car that I'm looking at is silver. Silver is not my favorite color in the world for a car. It's very plain. But there's this thing called vinyl car wraps now, where you can pretty much get any kind of color that you want. And people do them themselves. And I thought, that might be an interesting experience. So, once I get through these costumes, we'll see. We'll see where we go from there. Anyway, so that's that. So work is good. We're on break now. We'll be on break for the next week. It was really funny because I was a little disappointed this morning that I was on week-long break, because I look forward to these week-long breaks so much. And now that it's here, I know that it's going to be no time before it's over, and it's not going to be here. And then I'll be back at work, which is kind of weird. But anyway, so yeah, once that comes here and once we get to the 5th of the January, it will be 2 years and 6 months. So it'll be exactly 2.5 years before I retire. So we're just marking off the months. As far as interesting things that have crossed my path this week, there was an article that I came across last week, I think. And, you know, sometimes you read a lot of articles and you just shake your head, but... this article kind of put me to shame. And it's really, it's just really interesting. So apparently, Paxson, nope, that's not the name of the town. So the title of this article is What We Can Learn About Being Good from a Village That Saved Thousands During the Holocaust. This is by Maggie Paxson. She says, several years ago, I went off to research a remarkable community that has a history of sheltering vulnerable outsiders. I went looking for clues to how a community like that operates. I hoped I could learn some general lessons there about how groups of people can resist the call to violence, exclusion, and bigotry. So the tiny plateau of Vivarellis Lignon, I'm not going to say this right, in south central France is well known to scholars of the Second World War. During the German occupation of France, the region's farmers and townsfolk shelters hid, fed, schooled, and shuttled to safety hundreds, perhaps thousands, of war refugees, most of them Jewish, most of them children. They did this at great personal risk to their own lives. And they did it for years on end, not just for in one great burst of heroism. So as rare and extraordinary as this collective rescue was, I quickly learned that the Holocaust was not the first time the people of this community risked their own lives, their own safety to shield others from harm. They did it on and off for centuries during the religious wars between the Catholics and the Protestants, during the French Revolution, during the Spanish War, among many other conflicts that produce waves of displaced persons and trans-border refugees. So, you know, she also talks about how she went there and she got to see strangers, how they were treated in real time. Local people opened their homes, shared their knowledge and resources, helped families rebuild their lives. I saw how strangers were treated, not as examples of certain ethnic groups or religious groups or national groups, but simply as human beings, full stop. That is, humanity was something that everybody shared, no matter local and newcomers alike, no matter what they needed, no matter how the course of their own lives had unfolded. So, you know, that's pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing. The author actually has a connection to them. It says, many years ago, an aunt of mine gave me a book called Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed. She told me the story of the book was quite somewhat related to our family, was somehow related to our family. I took note but didn't quite understand the connection. Years later, when visiting the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., I saw an exhibit about the wartime efforts in the plateau, Vivarais, Lyon, Ligon. And it featured the family's name of my great-grandfather's second wife, who had been kind and loving presence in my childhood and who had once invited me to be with her in France. As I delved into the history of the plateau, I learned that this woman was in fact very closely tied to its rescue and resistance, to its story, closely tied to its story of rescue and resistance. So the woman who was the grandfather's wife of the author had a younger brother. His name was Daniel. And during the political turmoils of the 1930s, Daniel started questioning his life course. He started traveling extensively across Europe and Middle East and began to doubt the certainties he was raised in. As the war raged on, he received a request from a cousin who was then working as a pastor in this remote region of Vivarais, Lyon. And the cousin, Andy, was already making a name for himself. Anyways, received a request from a cousin. That cousin was already making a name for himself to help Jewish children who had found themselves taken to French concentration camps. So Daniel responded. He went there. He started taking care of the children. He paid for it by an arrest. He got arrested. He was sent to a concentration camp, died there. But Daniel's story for the author became a kind of lodestar for me for all my social scientific analysis trying to figure out what made the plateau and its people so expert in doing the right thing. I realized that none of this could tell me how I myself would behave when put to the test. I was haunted by the thought that no matter how hard you try to prepare, no matter how good you think you might be, you simply don't know the decision you would make when confronted with choice, Daniel's choice, to save himself or to stay behind and shelter others. And that's absolutely true, and it's absolutely sobering. The author goes on to say the more she in the course of her work, this younger brother, as an individual, a seeker, became more and more central to my story. I wanted not only to understand what the group did in theory, but how an individual faced with the worst possible times might make the right decisions. She said the farther she went in her journey, the more I saw I was no longer capable of making neat boxes where I separated science and analysis from the question of my very own heart, my very own soul. I see now that you can prepare and prepare, but the real work might be investing each moment you live with meaning. Like Daniel, you never know when the sky will open up or when men with guns will descend or a stranger will stand battered and afraid at your door and you will be put to the test. She said, it seems to me now that the people and entire communities can learn to be good in a couple of ways. They can learn when they grow up by habit. And this is how you treat strangers. This is how you handle your own identity, your sense of clan, your tribe, your nation, and make it at least equal to the needs of strangers. You can take as a given that you share a common humanity with them. You can learn those things so well that acting otherwise would be unthinkable. And the censure for acting in such a way would be great. The plateau gave its inhabitants over the centuries the gift of this habit. You know, the question is how? How did the plateau do this? And then she answers that question. And, you know, for all the analysis, for all the looking, for all the research, she answers the question by saying exactly the same thing that Jesus said 2,000 years ago. She says, how do you do that? You learn to love. You can use your religion to help you if you want. All religions, I believe, have that message at the core. Or you can use whatever other poetic, aesthetic, and humanistic tools you have. Well, maybe. When you fall in love, you overcome your own fears. See, it's not really falling in love, though, is it? It's really a decision to love. It says, places are good not because of the magic soil or enchanted water. The plateau isn't good for all these reasons. It's because the people who have lived there in the past, who call it home today, have learned something about the irresistible call to do the thing that they have carved in stone on the church in the center of one of the villages. It's in Latin. I'm not going to attempt it because I'll just massacre it. But what it is translated to is love one another. So apparently, somehow, there is a plateau in France where people live and they have actually worked out how to make this work at scale, to love one another. That seems like an amazing thing. It's called the Plateau of Viva, V-I-V-A, R-A-I-S, Vivares, dash, L-I-G-N-O-N. That sounds like a place to visit. Carved in stone on the church at the center of one of its villages, love one another. The author responds at the end of this article and says, it's a call we can all respond to. A toxin, T-O-C-S-I-N, I don't know that word, that can sound for all of us in our own terrible times. There is no them, only us. There is no then, only now. That's good. There is no them, only us. There is no then, only now. That is such a challenge. It's such a challenge. But it's one that we should all embrace because it is at the core of what Christ said to us. What are the greatest commandments? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. This is Phil Ferrant, and I have made it home.